Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP Athol, WDJM Framingham.
And let's now begin today's reading of the Boston Herald for this, the 9th day of July, 2026, on the Talking Information Center with the Boston Herald. We say hello to Herb.
Well, welcome again to the headlines. And the biggest one says, taking it to the street. The nurses at Brigham meet at State House. Also, goodbye to a legend. Our Denny V, gone too soon. As far as sports goes, we have France versus Morocco, Foxborough's last big game today. Scrubbing out. Thousands of nurses head to the picket lines in historic strike by Grace Zolkovich. Over 4,000 Brigham and Women's Hospital nurses and MGB home care clinicians took to the picket lines Wednesday for what is expected to be a five-day work stoppage, making history as Massachusetts' largest ever nurses' strike. Nurses with the Massachusetts Nurses Association, MNA, picketed by the thousands Wednesday following months of failing to reach a contract with the hospital system at the main Brigham and Women's campus in Longwood, as well as hospitals and home care sites in Foxborough, Somerville, Newton, Beverly, and more. The MGB has spent years disrespecting nurses and ignoring our safety concerns, said Kelly Morgan, a labor and delivery nurse at BWHMA Bargaining Committee Chair. Executives have refused for months to invest in nurses. Instead of making proposals that would make it harder to recruit and retain nurses, we're standing up for our patients, our profession, and the future of care at the Brigham. The 4,000 Brigham and Women's Hospital nurses with the union voted for a one-day strike starting Wednesday at 7 o'clock in the morning, but the work stoppage will continue for four more days to July 13th at 7 a.m. as the hospital institutes a lockout due to the extensive operational and emergency preparedness measures that are required to support uninterrupted patient care. The 450 MGB home care clinicians called a seven-day strike starting Wednesday, lasting through July 15th at 8 o'clock. MBG brought in nearly 1,300 nurses to replace the 4,000 on strike, and over 175 home care clinicians to replace the 450, stating that Brigham and Women's remains open and fully operational, and patients should continue to come to scheduled appointments unless they hear directly from their care team. Governor Marla Healy intervened following the start of the strike Wednesday, calling a 4 p.m. meeting at the State House with Mass General Brigham Management and the Nurses Union to push for a resolution, emphasizing the, quote, urgency of this situation, in a statement Wednesday afternoon. I met with MGB and MNA again today and strongly urged them to return to the bargaining table and continue negotiating in good faith, Healy said. It's essential that they reach an agreement that protects patient care and ensures the strong wages and benefits for our hardworking health care nurses. Following the meeting, the MNA said they were, quote, waiting for MGB to respond, as they remained invested in negotiating at any time to reach a fair agreement and resolve the strikes. Quote, we appreciate the governor's willingness to bring both sides into her office to discuss our positions, MNA spokesman Joe Markman said in a statement. We detailed to the governor our grave concerns about the level of care MGB's replacement workers are providing. Nurses and patient families have described harrowing conditions because MGB failed to staff adequately and hiring nurses without proper qualifications. MGB said that their current proposal would add meaningful value to the wage and benefit packages for nurses. The proposal continues the 5% increases throughout the 20-step wage scale and a 2.5 increase for nurses at the top step without adding to base wages. Their proposed compensation package adds about 30% through health care, retirement contributions, paid time off, and tuition support, MGB stated. Under the MNA proposal, the hospital system stated Brigham nursing salary and benefit expenses would increase from about $746 million to $920 million annually. Nurses' wages would represent nearly 50% of all BWH labor costs, MGB said, illustrating the significant financial impact of the proposal on the hospital's overall operating budget. The MNA said they are seeking, quote, competitive wage increases, noting that MGB has consistently proposed zero cost of living increases. The union is also seeking affordable health care, protection of threatened patient care services, and more. The union cited high inflation and a significant jump in cost of living in recent years and noted that MGB's top 14 executives received a combined $35.9 million in compensation in fiscal year 2024, including $8 million for CEO Director Ann Klebanski. The figure echoed in many signs on the picket lines Wednesday. Today, they were willing to pay a bunch of travelers a ton of money and not offer us even the slightest bit of a raise, which is just disrespectful, said BWH cath lab nurse Bana Kahaly. We come in here. I work 40-plus hours a week with on-call. Sometimes I do 22 out of 24-hour shifts a day where I'm taking care of really ill people, and it's just disrespectful. Cahill said she's lost some trust in the MGB bargaining, but there's always hope. Ventura covered state high schools athletic like a true pro. Coaches and colleagues praise a legend, by Greg Durek. Danny Ventura, the longtime face of Massachusetts high school sports coverage, who spent over three decades working for the Herald, died Tuesday night following a battle with cancer at age 66. Ventura was revered for his tenacious work ethic, encyclopedic knowledge, clever wit, and passion to put student athletes in the spotlight, and the news of his passing produced an outpouring of mourning from the high school sports community. Quote, it's a sad day for high school sports in Massachusetts, said renowned Catholic Memorial football coach John DiBasio, who was first introduced to Ventura when he coached at Weston in the 1980s. Ventura, who was raised in Brighton and became affectionately known by coaches, players, and readers as Danny V, worked in the industry for 40 years. Spent 35 of them with the Herald. He got his start with the Dedham Transcript in 1986 before joining the Herald in 1990. It didn't take long for Ventura to become intertwined with the identity of the Herald as his weekly Sweet 16 football rankings, which began in 1993, was a must-read item for players and coaches, along with his Thursday Pick-A-Rama column. In 2006, he succeeded Jim Clark as the Herald's high school sports editor, and his work became a staple in the sports section. He worked tirelessly, whether it was tracking down every score from Friday night's football games, compiling box scores on Thanksgiving, or writing out the state tournament's pairings for all sports in an effort to bring maximum exposure to high school athletics. Ventura was widely recognized for his impeccable coverage and received awards from five Massachusetts state coaches associations: football, baseball, basketball, wrestling, and swimming. "Danny V is forever a part of the history of the Herald," said Joe Grinnell, the Herald's executive editor. Quote, "His work ethic inspired us all, and we will never forget all he taught us on how to dig for the stories, no matter that matter to the readers." Joe Battenfeld's article today is titled Phony Warren Shifts Again with Political Wins. She was late to withdraw support for Plattner. Elizabeth Warren, belated withdrawal of her support for Maine Senate candidate Graham Plattner, long after a string of troubling allegations first surfaced in the latest politically expedient move by the opportunistic Massachusetts Democrat. The progressive darling senator has made an entire career of shifting with the political winds, ranging from finally disavowing Plattner along with other Democrats who did have to blasted the wealthy while amassing a small fortune herself from her books and speeches. In May, Warren traveled to Maine to buck up the embattled Plattner, proclaiming giddily, quote, "He's my kind of man." On Tuesday, after the New York Times reported a drunk Plattner sexually assaulted a former girlfriend, Warren put out a brief, late statement saying he should pull out of the race. Profile encouraged that. But should we really be surprised by Warren's late turn? She simply has no principles, except for her own political career. For her, it's all about convenience. 8 years ago, Warren led the Democratic charge against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh because of an unsubstantiated charge of sexual assault, lamenting that it's clear the fix is in. But now that the tables turned on a Democrat, Warren was fall in on Plattner, not believing the litany of allegations from other women until the latest charges finally forced her to hit reverse. Warren is just as big a phony as Plattner. Her career is littered with inauthentic, cringeworthy moments. Shortly after she announced her ill-fated campaign for president in 2020, Warren appeared on an Instagram live stream and in her best down-home Oklahoma accent The Harvard Law professor said, "I'm going to get me a beer." A Michelob Ultra, no less. It didn't work. Iowa's voters, who know a phony when they see one, resoundedly rejected her, and even in her home state of Massachusetts, she could only manage a dismal third-place showing behind Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. It was the ultimate humiliation that forced her to drop out of the race. In that campaign, Warren never lived down the disclosure broken by the Herald that she once claimed to be a Native American, a minority category that could have aided her career at Harvard Law. She listed herself as a minority in a legal directory used by other schools in the hiring process. In other words, she was politically expedient, even back before her political career. She even hired a well-known DNA tester for damage control and celebrated when the results showed a minute, almost negligible percentage of Native American heritage. But she quickly dropped the Native American claims during her campaign, knowing that voters would never buy it. The Native American controversy led to Donald Trump nicknaming her a derogatory name, and he welcomed her into the presidential race. "I hope she's running for president, because I think she'd be very easy," Trump accurately predicted. "I do not think she'd be very difficult to beat at all. I don't want to say bad things about her, because I hope she's one of the people that gets through the process." Throughout her Senate career, Warren has fought against large corporations, even when it hurts consumers. She cheered when a judge blocked troubled Spirit Airlines from merging with JetBlue, calling it a, quote, "a Biden win for flyers." The decision caused Spirit to fold. Warren has plenty to say when it suits her, but clams up when the questions get too tough. When asked by a dogged reporter chasing her down a street how she amassed an estimated $12 million net worth on her Senate salary, Warren refused to answer or even stop to say no comment. It wasn't convenient for her because she has spent her life trashing the rich. There's an article in the Associated Press titled "Platner's Plummet." The Democrat says he plans to withdraw from the Senate race after sexual assault claim. Graham Platner said Wednesday, that he plans to withdraw from the U.S. Senate race in Maine after facing an allegation of sexual assault, shuttering an insurgent campaign that had withstood months of controversy only to implode and imperil Democrats' attempt to regain power in Washington. Platner's exit will most likely force a reckoning within the party, which has been divided between its moderate and progressive factions, when it is struggling to unify during this year's midterm elections. Maine is considered a key state for control of the narrowly divided Senate, and Democrats were desperate for a candidate capable of defeating Republican Senator Susan Collins, while President Donald Trump is broadly unpopular. Platner says the process to replace him needs to be open, transparent, and democratic, and to reflect the will and values of people who supported him. He also lashed out at Democratic leaders in Washington, D.C. "People in D.C. need to stay in D.C., Blatton said. Decisions should not be made by people in places of political power. Blatton stressed that his decision was not an admission of guilt. Although Blatton had never before been elected office, progressive leaders promoted him over Governor Janet Mills, who was favored by the Democratic establishment. Mills dropped out of the race in late April, as Plattner, a military veteran and oyster farmer, consolidated support from primary voters who were eager for a more combative candidate and were willing to overlook his checkered past, which included a tattoo recognized as a Nazi symbol, online postings dismissive of sexual assault. Shortly before Plattner clinched the Democratic nomination in the June 9th primary, there were reports that he had exchanged sexually explicit messages with other women while married, and he had become physical with a previous girlfriend during an argument. But Plattner's support didn't crater until Monday, when Politico reported that a woman said he drunkenly forced her to have sex after she told him to stop. Jenny Rasico, who lives in Maine, told Politico she had been in an on-and-off relationship with Plattner, but cut off contact with him after that night in 2021 and told him the encounter was not consensual. In a CNN interview, she said she had been raped, quote, by definition. After the story was published, Plattner, in a video released on social media, denied the allegation as categorically false, but said he would be taking the time to reflect on the best path forward for his campaign. High-level backers pulled their support, including Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who said the next day that he spoke with Plattner and that, in light of these very serious allegations, I have recommended that he step aside. State law includes a provision for Democrats to replace Plattner before the general election. State Democratic Party held an emergency meeting Wednesday with more than 100 state committee members signed off on holding a nomination convention in the event of Plattner's withdrawal. This is titled another Associated Press article, The End of the Ceasefire. U.S. carries out another round of strikes on Iran. The U.S. carried out another round of strikes on Iran on Wednesday, hours after President Donald Trump said that recent Iranian attacks on ships in the Strait of Hormuz signaled the end of the ceasefire. Military people, officials said in a social media post that the strikes were intended to, quote, further degrade Iran's ability to threaten freedom of navigation in the strait. The action comes just a day after the U.S. military hit a variety of military sites and port facilities following Iran's targeting of several merchant ships off of the coast of Oman. The Social Security Post said that the U.S. is holding Iran accountable for recent unjustified aggression against commercial shipping and civilian crews freely navigating a vital international waterway. Iran state media reported explosions, including in the port city of Bandar Abbas on the strait and in Sirik, another southern coastal city. Early in the day, Trump said the U.S. would, quote, probably hit them hard again tonight, and later added that the latest back-and-forth fighting would not result in long-term military action. Anything that happens is going to happen very fast, Trump said, though he also suggested the military might just finish the job. The day after assaults on commercial shipping escalated into the exchange of strikes on Iranian and U.S. military targets, Trump also renewed his past threats to hit Iran's civilian infrastructure, including electric plants and desalinization plants, and to seize the oil production hub of Karg, K-H-A-R-G, Island. Speaking on the sidelines of a NATO summit in Ankara, Turkey, Trump said the strikes are continued retaliation by Iranian attacks on commercial ships in the Strait of Hormuz. They are behaving very badly, he said of Iran, accusing the country of launching drones and missiles at ships. After three tankers were hit Tuesday, the U.S. launched strikes on Iran, and Iranian forces retaliated by attacking American military sites in the Persian Gulf. Iran has asserted that the interim ceasefire deal gives it the right to manage traffic through the strait. Parliament Speaker Mohammed Bagher Qalibaf, a key negotiator in talks seeking a permanent end to the war, was defiant in a post on X, quote, "The era of bullying and extortion is over. It leads nowhere. We won't fold." The ongoing exchange of fire raised fears that the war in Iran could reignite. And Trump fueled those concerns by saying the interim agreement to pause fighting was, quote, "over," although he added that he would allow negotiations to continue. The attacks have repeatedly threatened the Shafi ceasefire, but Trump's comments added new uncertainty, and oil prices shot up after he spoke. A renewed conflict could engulf the wider Middle East and would likely again halt energy shipments through the straits that are critical to the global economy. "For me, I think it's over," Trump said when he asked about the status of the ceasefire. He said that U.S. representatives can continue negotiations, but he cast doubt on the outcome. "They can talk, but I think they're wasting their time," he said. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Kazim Garibabdi, also top negotiator, retorted on X that Trump's remarks are not a sign of power, but an admission of the failure of U.S. policy toward Iran. Trump has threatened to seize Karg Island in previous points in the war, including last month, where he also questioned whether the United States has a stomach for it. Some 90% of Iranian oil exports pass through the island. Inroads attacks on ships in the strait, despite the negotiations, could reflect a divide among Iran's leadership. Hardline seekers lasting control over the waterway, which is a globally important conduit for fuel shipments and has become a critical lever in confronting the West. Pragmatists want a permanent peace deal to lift international sanctions and provide desperately needed economic relief. Negotiations to reach a final deal had been due to start after the days-long funeral for Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, who was killed February 20th in the war's first movements. The funeral, which ends Thursday, was supposed to be a period of lower tensions. Talks are meant to focus on the toughest matters, including reopening the strait and rolling back Tehran's disputed nuclear program. On Tuesday, the U.S. military Central Command said American forces launched strikes to impose heavy costs for targeting and attacking commercial shipping crewed by innocent civilians in an international waterway. The military said it hit Iranian targets, including air defense systems, radars, and over 60 small boats used by Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard. Those boats have been key to threatening ships in the strait, through which a fifth of the world's trade, oil and natural gas, passes before the war. Iran's ability to bring shipping in the waterway to a near halt during the war proved its greatest strategic advantage. Iranian state media reported explosions in several locations, including in Bandar Manshashar, where the Revolutionary Guard member was killed. State television said eight members of the Army's air and naval forces were killed in Bandar Abbas and Bushehr. The latter is home to Iran's nuclear power plant complex. On Wednesday morning, both Bahrain, home of the U.S. Navy's 5th Fleet, and Kuwait, home to the U.S. Army forces, sounded missile alerts. Revolutionary Guard issued a statement acknowledging targeting of U.S. military installations in both countries. Kuwait said it intercepted two ballistic missiles, the three drones launched by Iran. Kuwaiti Electricity Ministry said a number of lines were out of service after shrapnel fell on them. Question about Kentucky Governor and Mitchell and McConnell. This is again by the Associated Press. Excuse me. Kentucky governor asks McConnell for a health update. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear is directly asking Senator Mitch McConnell, the state's most powerful figure in Congress, to disclose more about his condition. After 3 weeks of silence from the 84-year-old since he was hospitalized in Washington. The letter released Wednesday from Beshear, a Democrat, who's considered a potential presidential candidate in 2028, to the former state Republican leader, says Kentuckians have grown increasingly concerned about the current state of your health and well-being and ability to hold office. McConnell, whose physical condition has visibly declined in recent years, was hospitalized June the 14th. He has not released a public statement, photos, or videos since. Aides have disclosed nothing specific about his condition, other than to say last week that McConnell continues to improve and is working closely with his staff on Kentucky and Senate matters while the Senate is out of session. That lack of detail has fueled rampant speculation about his prognosis and whether he will return to the Senate when it reconvenes next week. Firestone was enough that Republican Senate leaders, including Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, and Wyoming Senator John Barrasso, on Tuesday made public statements saying they had talked to McConnell, that he was alert and discussing current events. Speaking to reporters on board Air Force One on Wednesday evening as he returned home following the NATO summit in Turkey, Trump was asked about McConnell, but said the pair had not spoken. "I have no idea how he's doing," Trump said. McConnell is retiring at the end of his term in January, and the campaign to elect his successor already is underway. Kentucky's Senate secession law, which Republican legislators have twice changed during Beshear's tenure, does not give the governor a role in picking a temporary successor should McConnell's seat become vacant before his term ends. Under the latest change in 2024, Beshear would call a special election if the seat became vacant. The winner of that election could take office after the result is certified. The general election winner would be sworn in as part of the new Congress in January. But there are unresolved questions about the timing of a special election under the untested law and the possibility the seat could remain vacant until January. Beshear ended the letter by wishing McConnell a safe and speedy recovery. Here's Peter Lucas's opinion piece today. And it is titled, "Democrats Need to Evict DSA from the Party." The establishment Democratic Party needs a pope. It needs a fearless leader to kick the crazed anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, democratic socialists of America out of the party, the way Pope Leo excommunicated a breakaway faction of the Catholic Church. The Vatican last week excommunicated four bishops and 750 priests of the Conservative Society of St. Pius X, and warned followers to stop participating in its events. It was the biggest church schism in over 100 years. That took bold leadership, something that is totally lacking among legacy Democrats. Church politics aside, it is something that Democrats should investigate before they are tested, and spit out by the military. And tough-talking Democrat Socialists of America, SOA, bent on wrecking the party before they wreck the country. So far, only Senator John Fetterman, Pennsylvania, who is not Jewish, has emerged as the main Democrat voice willing to take on the anti-Semites of the DSA. Even Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, who is Jewish, and who had his governor's mansion set afire during Passover in 2025, has, despite some tepid criticism, joined other Democrats attempting to make nice with the DSA. These include Kamala Harris, Gavin Newsom, Hakeem Jeffries, Barack Obama, and others who are shamelessly feeding the tiger rather than writing it. As a result, they are being eaten alive by New York Socialist Mayor Zoran Mamdani and his band of DSA congressional candidates he helped sweep into office in New York, Colorado, and elsewhere. Mamdani and the DSA have taken over the traditional Democratic Party by default, as gutless Democratic leaders run for cover to avoid being run over by the ultra-leftist, America-hating mob. Nothing else, Mamdani and the DSA are audacious, pushing a failed socialist agenda where it does not belong. Socialism, like Mamdani, is a huge con that has never worked anywhere. Who, other than foreign-born Mamdani, 35, who never ran anything before becoming mayor, would dump on the U.S. in a cringeworthy speech designed to preempt President Donald Trump on the eve of the 250th anniversary of the founding of our country? Mamdani, who was born to Indian parents in Kampala, Uganda, came to the United States at age 7, asked that his speech who America belonged to. He said, quote, "The powerful have always known the answer. America, in their view, is an area of supremacy where only a select few are allowed freedom, where not all are created equal. America, if you ask them, becomes less the more people in it welcomes. America, they'll tell you, belongs only to those with the right accent, the right shade of skin. The rest of us, they insist, should be grateful for merely being allowed to visit." This is coming from a man whose parents are multimillionaires, who lived a privileged life, graduated from Bowdoin College, and who never had a real job in his life. His political trajectory is like that of Melat Kiros, the Ethiopian-born DSA winner of a Democratic congressional primary in Colorado. She said that the U.S. essentially had its coming when Muslim terrorists crashed planes into New York City's Twin Towers, killing 3,000 people on September 11, 2001. As Fox News reported, when asked if the 9/11 attacks had been avoidable, Kiros said she believed the United States had made them, quote, inevitable through its foreign policy. Inevitable in the sense that we destabilized a lot of the Middle East. That forced people to believe that another act of violence was the only response, Kiros said in an interview. How much more honest and refreshing it would have been if Mamdani, instead of bashing the country that welcomed him, thanked the United States for giving him such a fine life. He could have talked about how great America is, how unique, free, and open country it is, a place where a Muslim boy from Uganda could grow up and become mayor of a New York City. Nowhere else is that possible, not in Moscow, Beijing, Pyongyang, Havana, or the capital of any other socialist paradise. Only in America. He knows it. But like a good socialist, he cons. Today's editorial reads, "A housing bill would place more homes within Americans' reach." An overwhelmingly bipartisan vote in the U.S. House and Senate, a rarity nowadays, reflects both parties' concern with rising housing costs nationwide and shows that political compromise is still possible in Washington, even as Donald Trump, president, has refused to sign the resulting housing bill. The bill has the potential to modernize federal housing programs, streamline regulations, and encourage innovation. Having said that, the 21st Century ROAD to Housing Act is not perfect legislation. It creates federal regulatory power over the housing market, but it does so in the service of removing bureaucratic hurdles, a positive outcome that can speed up construction. Even as politicians realize the need to provide affordable housing, local NIMBYism remains the greatest barrier to housing construction. Too often, opposition to mixed-use development and new housing of any kind is misguided and a losing proposition for everyone. This federal bill is tackling housing affordability by removing obstacles to housing. Ultimately, what we need is a mix of housing at various price points and with reasonable density. Local, state, and federal rules need to spur housing construction with the right incentives. This legislation works in that spirit. For one, the bill would speed up construction by making environmental reviews timely and less burdensome. It would direct the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to offer guidance on zoning for local communities. The legislation also grants greater flexibility in existing loan and grant programs to support rebuilding of older homes and converting vacant buildings. The bill also expands the definition of manufactured housing. A bipartisan policy center analyst argues this will make it cheaper and easier to mass produce these types of homes, unlocking a segment of the market. We would also highlight that the bill places new restrictions on the purchase of single-family homes by large institutional investors. These investors are making it harder for everyday Americans to afford a home. It will take time to see the effects of these measures, but it should help to increase the supply of homes in the long run. There are other variables at play, like the cost of materials and labor, but this bill will have a major impact. Trump has conditioned signing of the bill on the passage of the SAVE, Save America Act, an unrelated bill that adds voter identification requirements. But House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, said the president would not veto the bill either. This is an easy win for the president, for the American people. The president should get on board. The article, another Associated Press article, oil up the tensions with Iran. Oil prices rose, stock markets dropped. Shady trading worldwide Wednesday after President Donald Trump raised doubts about the temporary truce in the war with Iran. The S&P fell 500. The S&P 500 fell as much as 1.1% after Trump said the ceasefire agreement was over. But the index then was trimmed to a loss of 0.03 after Trump said recent fighting did not mean a return to a full-scale war. They are his latest mixed messages on what will happen with the war, which threatens to worsen inflation for the world. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 576 points, or 1.1, while the NASDAQ Composite rose 0.2% after erasing an early loss. The action was stronger in the oil market, where the price for a barrel of Brent crude climbed 5.2% to 78.02 and briefly topped $80. That's still below its peak from earlier in the war, when the price for the most activity traded contract reached nearly $120. But the jump is unsettling because oil prices had just dropped back to where they were before the war. The worry is that the continuation of the war will block the Strait of Hormuz and prevent the delivery of crude from the Persian Gulf to customers worldwide. That could worsen inflation, which economists expected would ease with oil prices and in turn force the Federal Reserve and other central banks to raise interest rates. Higher rates can keep the lid on inflation, but they also slow the economy and hurt prices for all kinds of investments. The Wall Street on Wall stocks of companies in the housing industry helped lead the way lower. They were hurt by worries that rising treasury yields in the bond market will mean higher rates for mortgages and chill the industry. Builders First Choice, which sells countertops, windows, and other building supplies, fell 5.4%. Home Builders Pulte Group fell 5.4%, and D.R. Horton sank 4.6%. Companies with big fuel bills also sank. American Airlines lost 4%, and cruise operator Carnival fell 3.9%. And now we turn to sports. The title, this is by Mac Cirillo, and he says that France and Morocco are set for a titanic rematch in Foxborough. Thursday afternoon, Gillette Stadium, temporarily renamed Boston Stadium for the World Cup, will host its final match of the tournament, and it's going to be a doozy. 4 years after facing off in the 2022 World Cup semifinals, France and Morocco are set to clash once again with a spot on the final four on the line. Last time, in Qatar, the French won 2-0 to secure a spot in the final, ending Morocco's bid for history. And this time, in Foxborough, the North American tide will look to avenge that defeat. The quarterfinal match set to begin at 4 p.m. and figures to be among the most compelling of the tournament so far. The world's number one team in FIFA's latest men's rankings, France has rolled through the tournament as it seeks its third consecutive finals appearance. Les Bleus are the perfect 5-0 in this World Cup, with a plus 12 goals common differential. Although the French faced an unexpectedly tough challenge from Paraguay in their round of 16 battle, winning 1-0 in a second-half penalty kick goal by superstar striker Kylian Mbappe. One of the world's most prolific goal scorers, Mbappe is again in the mix for the Golden Boot. The 27-year-old enters Thursday with 7 goals, which is tied with Norway's Erling Haaland for second in the tournament, behind only Argentina's Lionel Messi, 8, as well as 2 assists. Mbappe is also chasing Messi for the all-time World Cup scoring lead. The Argentinian legend has 21 gold, two more than Mbappe's 19. But the French aren't a one-trick pony up front. Ousmane Dembélé also ranks some of its scoring leaders with four goals and two assists, including a hat trick against Norway during France's previous group stage game in Foxborough, and midfielder Mikel Olise completes what widely regarded as the world's most dangerous attacking trio. Morocco will enter Thursday's rematch as an underdog, but the Atlas Lions are no Cinderella. Coming in at 16-6 in FAFA's ranking, Morocco made history in 2022 when it became the first African nation to reach the World Cup semifinals. Its four knockout stage wins over the past two tournaments match the combined total of every other African team in World Cup history, and a win over France would make Morocco the seventh team to reach the semis in consecutive tournaments. The others are a who's who of soccer royalty: Uruguay, Italy, Germany, Brazil, Argentina, and France. Morocco finished second in a Group C, tying with Brazil atop the standings with two wins and a draw each, but losing the goal sufferer, the goal differential tiebreaker, +6 to +3, Morocco tied Brazil 1-1 in their opening match before beating Scotland 1-0 in Foxborough and Haiti 4-2 to advance to the knockout rounds. And if that's all we have for today, I'm sorry. Thank you for listening, and have a blessed day.
The forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, sunny and hot, temperatures in the lower 90s. Overnight, cloudy, temperatures in the lower 70s. On Friday, increasing clouds, hot again, temperatures back into the lower 90s. The sun rose this morning at 5:17, setting at 8:22 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
The impact of a meal goes well beyond feeding our bodies, because when people don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, they can truly thrive, like Marta.
And now we'll hear from our class valedictorian, who with her hard work never ceases to amaze us. Please welcome Marta Moreno.
And Alex.
How did the interview go?
I did it! I got the job! I can't believe it!
I knew it. Let's meet up later to celebrate.
And Diego.
Mom! I got first place at the science fair with my volcano project!
That's amazing, sweetie. Congratulations!
Because when people are fed, futures are nourished, and everyone deserves to live a full life. Join the movement to end hunger at feedingamerica.org/act now. feedingamerica.org/act now. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Wouldn't it be great if life came with a remote control? You know, you could hit pause when you needed to, or hit rewind. Like that time you knocked down that wasp's nest.
Uh-oh.
Or that time you forgot to roll up your windows in the car wash.
Fantastic.
Yeah, a remote control would have come in handy then. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome. But prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Life doesn't come with a remote control. So you're on your own with the wasps. You have the power to take control of prediabetes. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WVBF Middleboro, WRS Middleboro, WRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLPFL, WDJ. I'm Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
Hello, everyone. This is Joan reading today's Washington Post, today being Thursday, July 9th. Graham Plattner ends U.S. Senate campaign in Maine. The Democratic nominee left the race following an allegation of sexual assault. Maine Democrats have until July 27th to choose a replacement candidate to take on Senator Susan Collins, Republican. Graham Plattner, the populist political newcomer, who Democrats had hoped could flip a critical U.S. Senate seat in Maine, ended his campaign Wednesday night with a bitter and defiant statement after a woman he previously dated publicly accused him of sexual assault. "We believe for the movement to continue, it can't be me. And for that reason, we are suspending campaign operations," Plattner said Wednesday night in an 11-minute video posted to social media. Even as he withdrew from the race, Plattner remained insistent that the accusations against him, as well as other controversies dating back to October, were false and part of a larger campaign by the establishment to put structural pressure on us. We live in a political system that is not built for normal people. It is a system that is built structurally to make sure that movements like ours cannot flourish, that if they begin to succeed, they can be crushed," Plattner said. "This is incredibly difficult because I know some will think it is an admission of guilt, and it most certainly is not," he continued. "We are not doing it because of the allegations. We are doing it because of the structures that are being taken from us by those in power." The development, a month after Plattner won the Democratic nomination to take on Republican Senator Susan Collins, injects fresh chaos into Democrats' uphill battle to retake the Senate in November. Democrats need to win 4 seats held by Republicans and hold their own to win control of the chamber. Democratic Party leaders have until July 27th to decide on a new standard bearer in one of the marquee races of the midterm elections, as Collins tries to hold on for a 6th term, representing a state that Democrat Kamala Harris won by 7 percentage points in 2024. The selection process remains unclear, but jockeying to replace Plattner began even before he dropped out. Several candidates have already publicly expressed interest in running, while Plattner allies urge Democrats to choose a new nominee who aligned with his politics, and Plattner privately sought influence over the decision. In the meantime, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee opened a nominee fund Wednesday night, a committee aide said, told the Washington Post. The committee will use the fund to raise money until a new nominee is selected to give the next candidate a running start. On a call with campaign staff to announce his withdrawal, Plattner said he has asked for assurances from the Democratic Party that they will ensure a process for a replacement nominee that respects the will of the voters who voted for a different kind of politics, according to a Democrat who participated in the call. What comes next is now in the hands of the main Democratic Party. The tenor of Plattner's exit, highlighted by his 11-minute straight-to-camera video, caught even some of his one-time supporters off guard. The presentation, however, was a condition of Plattner suspending his campaign, a person familiar with the video told the Post. Plattner, while holed up in his rural Maine home this week, told his most loyal aides that he would only suspend his campaign if he were allowed to say everything he wanted, the person said, leading to the lengthy, resentful recording. Democratic unease about Plattner had been growing for months. The 43-year-old's oyster farmer faced an escalating series of scandals since launching his challenge to Collins last summer, including old social media posts dismissive of sexual assault, a tattoo resembling a Nazi symbol that he later had covered up, sexually explicit text messages he sent to other women after he married in 2023, and allegations of physical violence by ex-girlfriends. Nevertheless, many high-profile supporters, including Senators Bernie Sanders, Democrat of Vermont, and Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, initially stood by Plattner. He attributed the revelations about his behavior to poor mental health and post-traumatic stress from his service in the Marine Corps and denied any violence. Then on Monday, a woman he previously dated came forward with a new accusation of sexual assault. Jenny Racicott, who said she dated Plattner on and off for 2 years, told the Post that he entered her home uninvited and intoxicated one night in late 2023 and forced himself on her while she told him to stop. Racicott said she cut off contact with Plattner after the alleged incident. The story was first reported by Politico. Plattner denied her story in a video posted to social media, but seemed to leave the door open to leaving the race. Any accusation of non-consensual behavior is categorically false, he said. Regardless of the inaccuracy of the reporting, but mindful of the political reality it will inflict, we're taking time to reflect on the best path forward for the state that I love, the people that I love, the movement I belong to, and the goal of defeating Susan Collins. Hours later, allies began to withdraw their endorsements. Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, who appeared at a rally for Plattner in Maine days after he was accused of violent behavior in past relationships, was the first to publicly say Plattner should withdraw. I've been very clear that sexual assault or violence against women is a red line, Khanna said on social media. These allegations are very serious and credible. The Maine Democratic Party also called on Plattner to leave the race, while Senate Democratic leaders said they would withhold financial resources if he continued his campaign. A pivotal moment came Tuesday when Sanders, one of Plattner's most influential and vocal supporters, joined the chorus. I have spoken with Bram Plattner about the best path forward for Maine, Sanders said in a statement. In light of these very serious allegations, I have recommended that he step aside. Also on Tuesday, a second ex-girlfriend told the Post that Plattner repeatedly removed protection without her consent when they were having sex. The campaign called the claim categorically false and politically motivated. Because Plattner withdrew from the race before a state deadline to finalize the November ballot, Maine's Secretary of State can declare a vacancy and allow Democrats to choose a replacement. The party now has until July 27th at 5 p.m. to select that candidate. It could get messy, with many seeking an open nominating process despite the tight timeline, to avoid the sense of coronation by party leaders that plagued Harris after she stepped in for President Joe Biden in 2024. Charlie Dingman, the chair of the Maine Democratic Party, and other party leaders, met with more than 100 state committee members on Wednesday. They said the group voted to hold a nominating convention to choose a new nominee if there is a vacancy to fill. Nirva Shah, a former public health official who finished second in the Democratic primary for governor last month and has expressed interest in a Senate campaign, suggested a televised debate and town halls. Meanwhile, many Platner supporters called rally behind former state senator Troy Jackson, who rode Sanders' endorsement to third place in the gubernatorial primary, arguing that he best represents what drew liberal voters to Platner. Jackson has formed an exploratory committee. Other potential candidates include Secretary of State Shannon Bellows, who finished fourth in the gubernatorial primary, David Costello, who finished third in the Senate primary and said he's back in if Graham Platner withdraws, and Dan Kelban, the Maine Beer Company co-founder, who briefly ran for the Senate last year. He saw a video of a Mexican man shot by ICE. It was his father. Ronaldo Salgado's mother called him early Tuesday morning, worried and seeking answers. His father had headed out to work, she said, and something had gone horribly wrong. The eldest son of Lorenzo Salgado, Arujo, got in his car and headed to Houston's northern suburbs. He knew his father had been working on a construction site there, just as he had nearly every day throughout the three decades he spent living in the United States. It was work that had allowed him to raise three sons and help send them to college, a job he did as an undocumented immigrant, hoping to one day have legal status and a shot at the American dream himself. Ronaldo Salgado found no sign of his father. The first inkling of what had happened surfaced on his phone. Community activists were posting about immigration and customs enforcement offices in the heart of a Houston neighborhood many Mexican immigrants call home. When he reached the site, Ronaldo Salgado saw his father's white work van. Then a video popped up on his social media feed. It showed a man struggling on the ground after being shot by an ICE officer. "I recognized him immediately," Ronaldo Salgado said, sobbing as he recounted the events to reporters. Not from his appearance, but from his voice, crying for help as he lay on the street bleeding out. Ronaldo Salgado relayed his panicked search for his father on Wednesday as he joined local legislators and activists in calling on the federal government and local authorities to conduct a full and transparent investigation into the killing. In the hours after the shooting, the Department of Homeland Security said an officer had fired in self-defense after Lorenzo Salgado refused to comply with orders and weaponized his vehicle in an attempt to run over an ICE law enforcement officer. That does not square with the man Ronaldo Salgado says his father was. Lorenzo Salgado Arujo, 52, had no criminal record, he said, and would have obeyed any orders to stop. Ronaldo Salgado said his father was pursued by two unmarked vehicles, and he believed that his father would have stopped and complied if they had ICE insignia or if he had known that the men were federal immigration officers. Lorenzo Salgado Arujo was anxious about being robbed of his work tools, and his son suspects he was gripped by fear in his final moments. ICE did not present itself in an orderly manner, Ronaldo Salgado said. His father was a simple man, wedded to his routines and work, the son said, and whose story echoed that of countless other immigrants. He'd marry the girl he fell in love with as a teenager in Mexico and forged a life in the U.S. building homes. People routinely knocked on his door seeking work, and he gave it to them. Eventually, he'd saved enough to build a home for his own family. It had a porch where he liked to sit and relax after a long day's work. On the last day of his life, Lorenzo Salgado Arujo woke up at 5 a.m., Ronaldo Salgado said. His father brushed his teeth, showered, and ate the hearty breakfast his wife had prepared for him. He got dressed and grabbed his lunch and coffee and put on his work boots. He gave his wife a kiss goodbye and patted their dog on his head. ICE activity had been picking up in Texas, and Ronaldo Salgado said his father had prepared for the possibility that he could get picked up. The family had settled on a plan. He would comply and sign nothing until his sons could work for his release. Despite their fears, Lorenzo Segato Arujo could not stop working, and he was doing what he could to legalize his status in the U.S., his son said. Lorenzo Segato Arujo had filled out paperwork for a legal work permit and submitted good character affidavits and fingerprints. Renato Segato said 18 months had passed, and they expected the permission to be approved. The son did not clarify what type of immigration status they were seeking. Lorenzo Segato Arujo's children are all U.S. citizens. Their father always told his sons, que siempre la equimos ganas en esta vida, invoking the Mexican proverb of perseverance that described generations of Mexican-American resilience. A rough translation, give it your all and never give up. When Renato Segato arrived at the scene of the shooting, he tried to get more information, but said he received little. The man shot had been taken to Ben Taub Hospital. That's where Lorenzo Segato Arujo's three sons had been born. His eldest headed over. He'd seen his father moving in the video shared on social media, which gave him hope he was still alive. Renato Segato said he couldn't get answers from the hospital staff. Instead, he found out his father had died from a news report. He called his mother, he said, to spare her the same indignity. Renato Segato and others described DHS's characterization of their loved one as a defiant illegal alien from Mexico. They also criticized the agency for releasing Lorenzo Segato Arujo's name before they said any authority notified them of his death. Three others, including Lorenzo Segato Arujo's brother, were also detained. He deserved to live a quiet life as Lorenzo Segato Arujo, a husband, father, and a job creator for dozens of men who also wanted the American dream, Renato Segato said, clutching a framed portrait of his father. The son closed his remarks in his father's mother's tongue. My father was always a strong man and never wanted us to know if he was in pain. He never complained, he said in Spanish, but it hurt my heart to hear his scream. U.S.-Iran trade, dozens more strikes in dangerous cycle. U.S. and Iranian forces exchanged overnight attacks for a second straight day, hours after President Donald Trump said he thought the ceasefire between Washington and Tehran was over. American forces struck about 90 Iranian targets to further degrade Iran's ability to threaten freedom of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz, according to statements from U.S. Central Command, which oversees military operations in the region. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said it responded by launching drones and missiles at U.S. bases in Kuwait and Bahrain. Fresh threats from both sides suggested an unwillingness to stand down as escalating friction punches a fragile truce. The strait has been a source of particular tension as Iranian forces have been accused of attacking commercial vessels, and the United States has responded. If it happens again, it will get much worse, Trump said Wednesday in a Truth Social post that was accompanied by an image of a billowing fire. Speaking in Turkey earlier in the day, Trump said that, I think a tenuous ceasefire agreement reached between U.S. and Iranian officials in June was over. However, he later qualified his remarks, saying that any military action would end very quickly and that he didn't think the U.S. military would return to full-scale war. Trump's remarks at a meeting of NATO leaders here in Ankara followed a separate U.S. assault in Iranian territory, involving more than 80 strikes, ordered in response to attacks on ships passing to the Strait of Hormuz. Trump said the U.S. hit Iran very hard last night and will probably hit them hard again tonight. The president also suggested that the U.S. could reimpose a naval blockade on Iran and that Washington was not attacking at the highest level, repeating previous threats to strike infrastructure such as bridges, desalination facilities, and electricity plants. U.S. officials declined to detail what might be planned up, but said in a social media post later in the day that more than 20 U.S. warships remain in the Middle East. Oil prices hit ease but quickly spiked on Wednesday. Brent crude futures rose more than 5% to over $78 per barrel on fears that a renewed war could further disrupt energy supplies. But Trump offered an evolving account of his plans in multiple appearances over the course of the day, by nightfall suggesting that any additional fighting was likely to remain contained. "I don't think it's going to start again," he said at a news conference before returning to the United States. "I think it's going to go very quickly. They hit a couple of ships, and so we hit them much harder. We use their language. We speak their language." The president spoke after Iran launched heavy retaliation overnight with the IRGC, saying it had targeted 85 U.S. military facilities in Bahrain and Kuwait on Wednesday, according to the semi-official media outlet Fars. "They're scum. They're sick people. They're led by sick people. And they're vicious, violent people," Trump said in his comments earlier Wednesday. "Far as I'm concerned, it's just a waste of time dealing with them. They're liars. There's something wrong with them. They're cuckoo. As far as I'm concerned, it's over." Trump said that talks with Iran could continue, but that he was deeply skeptical they would be productive. "They can talk, but I think they're wasting their time. They're a bunch of lying guys," Trump said. "They're bad people, and frankly, I don't want to waste my time with them. Now I'll let our wonderful negotiators keep talking if they want, but I don't see it." Later in the day, Trump declared that he was Iran's top target for assassination. "I'm their number one target. It's out all over the place," he said, "because they're scum. That's the way they act, and that's the way they've done it for 47 years. Adding to speculation about Iranian threats to his life, Trump also abruptly announced Wednesday that he would not be departing Turkey on the new Qatari luxury 747 that he debuted as Air Force One last week. Instead, he said he would depart on one of the older, smaller 747s that have been in service since 1990, jumping back to the fancier plane in Britain. The Qatari jet, whose $400 million overhaul was accelerated by the U.S. Air Force when it took possession of the plane last year, is unlikely to have the same self-defense capabilities as the older, highly modified plane. That could pose a problem when flying out of Turkey, which shares a border with Iran. Trump framed the move as a chance for U.S. service members based in Britain to explore the new jet. But asked Wednesday whether he had changed his plans because of security concerns, he didn't answer directly. The president's tone about Tehran was a marked change from his assessment of Iranian leaders just weeks ago, when he praised their interest in making a deal shortly after they agreed to the ceasefire. Asked why he was now dismissing them as scum, Trump said that, "I got to know them." The Secretary General of the International Maritime Organization, Arsenio Dominguez, in a statement Wednesday, urged shipowners to avoid exposing their crews to danger by crossing the Strait of Hormuz, as long as the safety and security of crews cannot be assured. The U.S. and Iran reached a preliminary peace deal last month to reopen the strait to shipping traffic while continuing to discuss the Nathornia nuclear issue and possible lifting of U.S. sanctions against Tehran. The strait is a crucial shipping choke point through which 20% of global oil products normally flow. But the tentative agreement appeared to collapse less than halfway through the 60 days that negotiators had allotted to reach a more durable accord. Trump previously expressed hope that the negotiations would lead to strict controls on Iran's nuclear program. The renewed hostilities were a setback for the president, who cited his concern about becoming a new Herbert Hoover as a major reason for seeking peace when he announced the initial deal last month. Hoover was president at the start of the Great Depression in 1929. Iranian leaders, too, had seemed to be interested in peace. The country had been focused on days of mourning and funeral rites for its supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who was killed in an airstrike during the first hours of the war. But negotiations had stalled. Talks began with days of delays before Vice President J.D. Vance flew to Switzerland to kick them off. And the two sides traded barbs and sporadic strikes from the get-go. Trump expressed frustration on Wednesday that Iran's public representation of what was being discussed differed from his understanding. We make a deal. Everyone's agreed. No nuclear weapon. We make a deal. They go outside, joke to the press. They say we never even talk about it, Trump said. Iran's leaders in recent days have appeared emboldened, with several senior officials appearing in public for the first time since the start of the war as part of the mourning rituals for Khamenei. The possible resumption of war sparked some concern in Congress, which has sought to restrict Trump's ability to keep fighting. In June, the House and Senate passed a resolution to block Trump from resuming military action in a bipartisan effort to rein in the Iran war. The White House has argued that the measure does not have the force of law, setting up a clash with congressional Democrats who sponsored the legislation. The top Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Representative Gregory Meeks of New York, who helped lead a vote to restrain Trump from resuming the war, said in a statement Wednesday that he was exploring any and all legal pathways to hold Trump accountable for the renewed strikes. Iran's IRGC on Wednesday described the strikes on the 85 targets as its initial response to the U.S. aggression. Inside Iran, national news coverage remained dominated by the Supreme Leader's funeral that began commemorations in neighboring Iraq on Wednesday. A number of senior Iranian officials had traveled to Iraq for the events in Najaf and Karbala. Iran has interpreted the initial peace deal with Trump as granting Tehran authority over all vessels transiting the Strait of Hormuz and has raised the idea of collecting tolls. Iranian attacks appear to be targeting vessels seeking to skirt Iranian authority by using an alternative route along the coast of Oman. There is no other way. Recognize the new Iranian regime in the Strait of Hormuz, said Ibrahim Azizi, a senior member of the Iranian parliament, who is also the head of parliament's National Security Committee. Three tankers were damaged in recent days while passing through the strait, said UK Maritime Trade Operations, a monitoring agency that is part of Britain's Royal Navy. The latest round of U.S. strikes hit Iranian Air Defense Systems Command and Control Networks, coastal radar sites, anti-ship missile weapons, and more than 60 small boats associated with the IRGC, Iran's parliamentary paramilitary force, according to a statement from U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in the Middle East. The effort is meant to degrade Iran's ability to continue attacking commercial shipping, the statement said. Both the U.S. and Iran accuse each other of violating the ceasefire. Iran's parliamentary speaker, Mohammad Bagah Ghalibaf, said that their era of bullying and extortion is over in a post on X Tuesday. It leads nowhere. We don't fold, he added. Iran's foreign ministry blamed the U.S. for the latest escalation in a statement Wednesday, saying the U.S. had violated the tentative peace agreement by revoking a waiver for Iranian oil sales a day earlier. The extent of the damage from Iran's overnight attacks on U.S. allies in the Gulf was unclear early Wednesday. Kuwait's Ministry of Defense said it had intercepted two ballistic missiles and 13 drones, while the country's Ministry of Foreign Affairs condemned Iranian aggression as efforts to de-escalate regional tensions are underway. Bahrain's defense ministry denounced Iran's treacherous missile and drone strikes in a statement Wednesday, saying air defense had intercepted a number of aerial attacks without elaborating on the targets or if any damage was caused. In shift, Trump praises Zelensky will let Ukraine build Patriot missiles. President Donald Trump heaped praise on Ukraine's president and war effort Wednesday, speaking in unusually positive terms about Kyiv's deep strikes inside Russia and appearing to grant one of Ukraine's long-held requests, the ability to produce U.S.-designed Patriot air defense missiles on Ukrainian soil. Trump's words on Ukraine were a dramatic departure from his tone during his first year in office, when he called Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky ungrateful for U.S. help and accused him of gambling with World War III. Wednesday, he spoke in admiring terms of Ukraine's war effort and offered dramatic new assistance, first in a closed-door meeting with NATO leaders and then in a one-on-one with the Ukrainian leader. Wednesday afternoon's meeting was almost chummy by comparison with the earlier encounter. Zelensky has done an amazing job, Trump told reporters before the pair's bilateral meeting on the sidelines of the NATO summit. Look, he's been very effective, and he's had the best equipment because he's had our equipment. Trump went beyond warm praise. He said the United States will allow Ukraine to manufacture Patriot missiles, the interceptors used to knock Russian missiles and drones out of the sky before they can strike cities, power plants, and other civilian infrastructure. We're going to give a license to you to make Patriot missiles, Trump said. That's pretty cool. This way you can't complain that we're not giving them enough, I said. Make them yourself. We haven't informed the company of that yet, but that'll work out all right. The president also said he was willing to send some Patriot interceptor missiles from the U.S. stockpile, though the numbers the Pentagon possesses have been dwindling after years of aid to Ukraine, and more recently, their use during the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran. For Zelensky, the issue is not abstract. Patriot systems have become one of Ukraine's most prized defenses against Russian barrages, particularly ballistic missiles that can reach Ukrainian cities in minutes and leave civilians with little warning. They have been in short supply for years. Kyiv has repeatedly pressed allies for more batteries and interceptors, warning that every shortage gives Moscow more room to terrorize apartment blocks, energy facilities, and other civilian targets. As long as Patriot missiles remain in our allies' stockpiles instead of being handed to Ukraine, Zelensky said in a statement Monday, Russia is only encouraged to keep vanquishing residential buildings. Being able to manufacture Patriot missiles in Ukraine could eventually bolster the country's defenses. The immediate impact may be small. Setting up factories will take time, and any such facility would immediately become a top target for Russian airstrikes. Russia launched a major air assault on Kyiv on Monday, the day before the NATO summit started, killing at least 19 people. The U.S. move is likely to be interpreted as an aggressive action by the Kremlin and is a departure from Trump's previous efforts to try to keep an equal distance from Kyiv and Moscow to seek a peace deal. U.S. military planners have typically drawn distinctions between offensive and defensive weaponry and how they calibrate their aid to Ukraine, mindful of how they manage escalation. Patriots are defensive, but as for his assessment of Ukraine's long-range drone campaign, attacking oil refineries and other targets deep in Russia, Trump praised Kyiv. It's an escalation, but it's also an escalation that can help lead to an end of the war, Trump said, embracing the view that Ukraine and many Europeans have long held. European leaders who took part in the meetings embraced the new messaging. It's so important that the U.S. and Trump are now taking very seriously that Ukraine has a chance and Russia is doing weaker, Estonian Foreign Minister Margus Tašaka said in an interview. Maybe we can see the start of the end of the war. We don't know yet. Zelensky, speaking alongside Trump ahead of their meeting, expressed happiness for the U.S. support. We understand what to do. It's our estimation what to do, how to win, he said. It was his second meeting with Trump in less than a month. After seeing the U.S. leader in France on the sidelines of a meeting of the leaders of the Group of Seven major economies, Zelensky showed swagger and a hint of his presidential vocation as a popular Ukrainian comedian. Asked by Trump whether he would go to Moscow for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin, Zelensky said that it's difficult. There are a lot of Ukrainian drones there. It's dangerous, he said, drawing laughter from the room. Trump spoke to both Putin and Zelensky by phone on Saturday, a fact that may heighten the Russian leader's disappointment with Trump's approach to the conflict on Wednesday. Putin has often sought to shape Trump's attitudes in phone calls ahead of his meetings with other leaders, and the Kremlin described Saturday's conversation as nearly 90 minutes long and businesslike. Trump plans to speak to Putin again after Wednesday's meeting, a U.S. official said, ahead of the summit. The extended conversation with Putin does not seem to have averted Trump's boost to Zelensky on Wednesday. In a separate Wednesday meeting, between Zelensky and a bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers, the Ukrainian leader was upbeat about his country's chances, confident that Kyiv had turned the tide on the battlefield. Ukraine estimates that Russia is losing 30,000 troops a month while making nearly no territorial gains, according to a person who participated in the meeting and spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the sensitive, closed-door conversation. The momentum is on the side of Ukraine at this point, and we need to do everything possible to ramp up pressure on Russia to come to the negotiating table and to get a deal, said Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat of New Hampshire, speaking ahead of the meeting with Zelensky. Smithsonian head disputes White House report in memo to staff. Smithsonian Secretary Lonnie G. Bunch III issued a defense of the National Museum of American History to staffers on Tuesday in response to a caustic White House report accusing the museum of pushing extreme political activism. In an email obtained by the Washington Post, Bunch wrote to staffers that we continue to review the report and its findings carefully and that there will always be room for improvement. But the report is not a fair characterization of the works and totality of the National Museum of American History, he added. At the Smithsonian, our work is driven by scholarship, accuracy, and an uncompromising commitment to tell the fullness of America's story. The 162-page document, credited to the White House's Domestic Policy Council, was released on Saturday. It largely focused on the American History Museum and criticized its leadership as having explicitly adopted an ideological framework that no longer treats the American story as a shared national inheritance to be taught or celebrated, but as a political instrument to divide, disparage, and discourage our citizens. The Smithsonian Institution has offered little public defense since the report was released. On Sunday, a spokesperson said in a statement, for more than 180 years, the Smithsonian has served the American public with nonpartisan and independent scholarship, and we remain committed to doing so. The Smithsonian referred to that statement when asked for comment Wednesday. In the email Tuesday, Bunch praised and thanked staff across the museums, writing, as public servants and the keepers of this institution, we are charged with helping a nation find understanding, hope, and clarity. And as part of that duty, we are dedicated to excellence, reflection, and growth. He said the institution remains committed to scholarship, nonpartisanship, independence, accuracy, and integrity. Outside scholars have come to the defense of the museum. The Organization of American Historians, in a statement Monday, condemned the White House report as part of an ongoing and multi-pronged assault by the Trump administration against accurate and evidence-based history in American public life. Titled Saving America's Story, the White House document comes more than a year after President Donald Trump signed an executive order aimed at eliminating divisive narratives from the Smithsonian Institution's museums. Bunch, 73, has led cultural institutions for decades and served as the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture from 2005 until 2019. That's when he became 14th Secretary of the Smithsonian, a position complicated during Trump's second term as the president, based on reshaping the country's premier cultural organizations. Just months after signing his executive order, Trump effectively forced out Kim Stajic, the longtime director of the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, who resigned after he claimed to fire her. Bunch, who has a reputation for skillfully navigating political tensions, has mostly declined to confront the president publicly, reaffirming his belief in the institution's commitment to scholarship and accuracy. The Smithsonian receives both public and private dollars and is governed by a board of regents made up of citizens, members of Congress, Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr., and Vice President J.D. Vance. After Greenland bluster, Trump surprises NATO allies with praise. After public bluster over Greenland and other grievances, President Donald Trump embraced the NATO alliance at a summit of its leaders on Wednesday, praising countries that have boosted their military spending and offering fresh support for Ukraine in its war with Russia. The positive tone in a closed-door meeting surprised many other NATO leaders who had been bracing for a verbal barrage after Trump's rebukes of the alliance. The president had complained for months about European criticism of the U.S. war against Iran. Ahead of Wednesday's meeting, he also declared that he still wants to take Greenland from NATO ally Denmark. Once the doors closed in the soaring presidential palace in the Turkish capital, however, Trump focused more on the positive. Officials who were in the room with him said he highlighted countries that were meeting new, higher NATO spending goals, but didn't mention laggards by name. And he did not mention Greenland once the meeting started, easing European fears that he was seeking to put the island territory back on the front burner. Despite U.S. plans to pull assets from the continent, Trump also held back from announcing concrete steps to withdraw U.S. troops from Europe or otherwise slash the U.S. commitments to the military alliance. They said, "We love, sir. We love you." These are grown people saying that. "Isn't that nice?" Trump told reporters after the day of meetings. "Maybe. I don't know. Maybe they're trying to get to me." And in a way they did, because there was tremendous unity in that room. There was love in that room. It was great. So this was a tremendously successful summit, Trump added. Earlier, in a separate meeting with Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, Trump praised the Ukrainian war effort, a notable shift in tone for him. Top policymakers in the alliance meeting with Trump said other leaders took turns praising defense spending increases and efforts to strengthen NATO after comments from the host, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and the U.S. President. The main message was about unity, Estonian Defense Minister Hanno Pevkur said in an interview after the meeting. It was more optimistic than maybe many were afraid of. Trump did press NATO countries to meet spending targets, and sooner rather than later, which is also okay for us, because we've been saying that for the last 4 years, Pevkur said. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said that Trump listened attentively to others and that the U.S. president ended his remarks by saying that there is a feeling of love in the air. Merz credited Trump with pushing Europe to spend more on the continent's defenses, which he said other U.S. presidents had requested well before Trump assumed office. "The president is now doing it in a different way, but the result speaks for itself," the German leader said. And perhaps, to put it somewhat bluntly, the Europeans' free riding is now over. The narrative of harmony ended the day on a very different note than the one on which it started. Earlier Wednesday, Trump's repetition of his bid for Greenland threatened to revive a dispute that has sparked European fury and fear, perhaps more than anything else during his time in office. Just before the closed-door meeting, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen had declared that her country would defend its territory as Trump returned to his demand for control of Greenland. Tensions between Trump and U.S. allies had soared earlier this year as he seemed to push NATO to a breaking point with threats to seize the vast Arctic expanse that is an autonomous territory of Denmark. After European leaders stood up to the president, Trump backed down in January, saying he had reached the outlines of a deal brokered by NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. But almost as soon as he arrived to meet NATO counterparts in Turkey, Trump told reporters that Greenland should be controlled by the United States, not by Denmark. The president said he planned to use the annual meeting, which gathers leaders of NATO's 32 nations, to relay my problems. "Greenland is a big problem for us," he added. Laying out his complaints about fellow NATO members, states, Trump also took aim at the hesitation of European allies to get embroiled in the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran. "I'm not happy with NATO," Trump had said repeatedly, sitting alongside Rutte before the mood shifted at the closed-door meeting. European leaders have sought to distance themselves from the war, which is unpopular across much of the continent, although some nations, including Germany and Britain, lent their bases and airspace to the U.S. bombing campaign. Privately, Rutte has noted to Trump the significant European outlays on U.S. defense and technology, cautioning that if the U.S. scares Europe into worrying it could turn into an enemy, countries will pull back investments no matter how hard Trump pressures them, officials familiar with Root's strategy say. In some cases, a rift has already started, as major European companies shift their platforms toward European software, and some capitals push to limit spending on U.S. systems to curb reliance. If we are spending more money, it is not to spend it on non-European systems, French President Emmanuel Macron told reporters Wednesday. Macron added that France and its European neighbors are here to replace military assets as Washington pulls back from NATO. At the meeting on Wednesday, the tone was unusually positive. Four senior officials who were inside the room said, speaking on the condition of anonymity, to be candid. Even Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, who has tangled with Trump on defense spending and his opposition to the Iran war, took a turn to praise his leadership, they said. Trump had started the day threatening to cease trade relations with Spain, which runs a trade deficit with the U.S. Spain is chief among the European nations that block U.S. access to their airspace for attacks on Tehran. Don't even talk to them, Trump said. They're hopeless. They're bad people. Yet Sanchez later told reporters that he had an informal chat with Trump, including about the World Cup. There was no tension. On the contrary, it was all kind words, he said. Trump's silence about Greenland at the formal meeting sparked speculation about why he had brought it up in front of the press, one of the officials said, and whether it was an attempt to pressure Denmark in negotiations. Many leaders were happy to accept Wednesday's version of Trump, but resigned to the head-snapping nature of their relationship, the official said, adding that fresh fights were likely eventually. NATO diplomats had expected Trump to use the two-day gathering in the Turkish capital to lament Europe's criticism of his war with Iran, war of its long-standing reliance on U.S. protections. But his comments on Greenland caught some off guard. Frederiksen has said in recent months that she didn't believe the ordeal was truly over, even after Root assuaged Trump with promises of increasing the NATO and U.S. military presence in the Arctic. Arriving at the summit early Wednesday, Frederiksen said Denmark's position is as clear as it has been all through. Greenland is, of course, not for sale. We are a sovereign state, she told reporters, and we need everybody to respect our territorial integrity. The Danish leader noted that NATO was meant to ensure allies help defend each other from outside threats. European officials say Trump's public skepticism about defending U.S. allies has spurred a reckoning over Article 5, which states that an attack against one NATO ally should be considered an attack on all members. Still, in a joint declaration about after Wednesday's summit, which Trump signed, leaders reaffirmed commitment to their defense pact, also pledging that Europe would keep backing Ukraine and assume a bigger role at NATO. European leaders say they are not simply appeasing Trump, but rearming to prepare for a potential confrontation with Russia as trust in the U.S. wavers. Still, NATO officials came to the summit flashing big numbers that could appeal to Trump, signing weapons deals and highlighting the hundreds of billions of dollars that European nations have recently diverted to defense and security. Our arms deal floated before the summit did not immediately materialize, however. Trump departed without announcing a final decision to allow Turkey to purchase American F-35 fighter jets. Root, who has gone to great lengths with his flattery to keep Trump on side, heaped fresh praise on the U.S. president Wednesday for pressuring European nations to raise their military spending as he sought to de-escalate once again. Grab the win. It's there. You did this, Root told the president. The NATO chief has maintained that there is a good process in negotiations on Greenland, home to about 56,000 mostly Inuit people. Technical talks between U.S., Danish, and Greenland officials began after Root defused the crisis in January, but officials say they have yielded few concrete results. Talks have previously broached increasing the presence of U.S. troops or bases in Greenland, offering the U.S. greater access to investment in mineral extraction, and for a multi-layered air defense system called Golden Dome. E. Jean Carroll must be paid $5 million award from Trump's suit, judge says. A federal judge Wednesday ordered that E. Jean Carroll receive the $5 million awarded to her by a jury that found President Donald Trump had sexually abused and defamed her. The order, which Trump quickly appealed, came after the U.S. Supreme Court last week declined his petition to take up the case. Carroll, a writer, had in 2019 accused Trump of sexually assaulting her in the mid-1990s. Trump responded with repeated denials and verbal attacks on Carroll, leading her to file two civil lawsuits against him. After the first lawsuit went to trial in 2023, jurors awarded Carroll $5 million in damages. The outcome was upheld by a federal appeals court panel in 2024. The Supreme Court let the judgment stand and did not offer an explanation about why it did not take the case. In a two-page order filed Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Louis A. Kaplan in New York pointed to the Supreme Court denial in concluding that Carroll should receive the money and interest that had accrued. After Kaplan's order, Trump's attorneys filed a notice of appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Carroll's other lawsuit against Trump went to trial in early 2024, leading to a much larger financial penalty for him. The jury in that case ordered Trump to pay Carroll more than $83 million for defaming her, a judgment that was upheld by an appeals court. In a filing on Wednesday asking the Supreme Court to reconsider denying his appeal of the $5 million case, an attorney for Trump said it was needed because he imminently planned to ask the justices to hear his appeal of the $83 million case. Trump's appeal of the $83 million case will overwhelmingly likely bear on the proper disposition of the $5 million one, the filing stated. Attorneys for Trump did not respond to a request for comment about the filings Wednesday. A representative for Carroll declined comment. Trump has roundly criticized Carroll, her cases against him, and the verdicts in them, deriding Carroll's allegations as fiction. During one of her cases against Trump, Carroll testified that his rhetoric had damaged her reputation and prompted a torrent of harassing, threatening messages. The day after the Supreme Court declined to hear Trump's appeal in the $5 million case, attorneys for Carroll wrote in a court filing that it was time for this case to end. Carroll was entitled to the judgment plus interest, which amounts to more than $5.7 million in total, the attorneys wrote. There was no need to further delay paying her, the lawyers said, adding that the Supreme Court was unlikely to reconsider its action. Carroll had agreed to repeated delays in receiving the payment, the attorneys continued, but that cooperation ends today. Attorneys for Trump, meanwhile, wrote Tuesday that the money should not be dispersed until the Supreme Court weighs in on Trump's latest request. If the money is dispersed, they said, Trump faces an unrecoverable loss because Carroll has said she plans to give away the money, so it likely cannot be recovered. And next, we got your opinion from Karine Haja. Who vetted Graham Plattner? Anyone? Democrats want a fighter badly enough to sacrifice their standards. Imagine the ecstasy Democrats felt when they first found Graham Plattner. The party, which lost chunks of its working-class base to Donald Trump in 2024, had discovered a gruff-talking, flannel-wearing, oyster-shucking, progressive man of the people. It made him the perfect person to challenge Senator Susan Collins, the Republican incumbent, who had vanquished every opponent she'd faced since 1996. In all the excitement, though, it seemed that the party ditched proper vetting. The result was that the 41-year-old political novice was covering up a Nazi tattoo 2 months into the campaign. Democrats evidently reasoned that a checkered past in the Trump era needn't tank a political career, and so party loyalty lined up behind the self-described vegetable-growing, psychedelics-taking socialist. Never mind that doing so normalized what would have been considered disqualifying behavior a year before. When an ally who challenges power is under attack, one prominent Democrat advised in June, party members need to fight harder. That ethos meant that until Jenny Resicott alleged this week that Plattner raped her in 2021, Democrats had taken to excusing the inexcusable. the Totenkopf on his chest. He didn't know any better. Online posts suggesting rape. Victims should take some responsibility for themselves. The candidate had grown. He shouldn't be judged for sexting with women who weren't his wife. And the allegations of mere physical abuse from an ex-girlfriend were probably politically motivated. She was a Republican, after all. Seems like a lot of nothing, one senator wrote last month. To counter Collins' record, Democrats put their trust in Morris Katz, a now 27-year-old alumnus of Zoran Mamdani's New York City mayoral campaign, who helped produce the video that sent Plattner into the progressive stratosphere. The aspiring poem, molded into frame with the main coastline as a backdrop, interspersed with shots of kettlebell swinging, wood-chopping machismo, and vows to fight the oligarchy. But it wasn't just an aesthetic match. He shared activist radical urban politics, too. The party needed something different, and the bet seemed to pay off. Plattner won his primary on June 9th. Yet in shielding their old polish, Democrats along the way also dropped all sense of standards, too. Candidates rarely tick all the boxes on ideology and image, and a few shallow scratches would have revealed deep flaws in Plattner's candidacy. Put aside the long list of personal scandals, the oyster man, which, by the way, isn't a term actual oyster farmers use, turned out not to be the working-class kid he portrayed on stage. The facade started to crack somewhere between revelations about his private schooling, his dad helping out with his mortgage, and his mom's restaurant being his biggest client. Genevieve McDonald, Plattner's former political director, was one of the first people to warn Democrats that their vetting failure was turning into willful blindness. She quit the campaign last October after learning about his trove of Reddit posts. Despite his denials, the archive of offensive internet commentary revealed that he knew what the skull on his chest meant. I was an outcast of the main Democratic Party for a number of months due to my refusal to accept Plattner as a viable candidate, McDonald told me. There were a number of red flags it chose to ignore because it thought he could win. Allegations of rape made by a woman who sympathizes with Plattner's platform were finally what did it. Plattner denies those too, but on Monday, state party leadership urged him to drop out. It was clear for months that Plattner was a moral liability, and yet the apologies continued. Coaxed by the fawning hosts at Pod Save America, the quartet of former Obama staffers, the party was willing to buy Plattner's excuses to harness his working-class bona fides. I hope everyone with reservations takes a little time to get to know the real-life version of him, not what the algorithm throws in our faces, John Favreau wrote in April. But people in Maine did get to know him, and the gruffness wasn't translating into actual working-class appeal. As of last week, Plattner trailed Collins by 21 points among non-college-educated Mainers, but led by 37 among white college-educated voters. McDonald, a former commercial fisherman, told me that working-class Mainers don't act like Plattner or accept that type of behavior. But the basic decency of those Maine voters was lost on Dems after the sexting story broke in late May. Plattner rushed to assure senators that nothing worse was coming. Senator Tina Smith, Democrat of Minnesota, said she left the meeting excited. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, was reported as saying there was a difference between marriage problems and alleged sexual assault. Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, disliked the distraction, saying the party should be focusing on the crisis facing the working class and electing people of the guts to stand up to the oligarchs who control our country. Each has since called on him to drop out. The debacle was able to fester in the first place because of another party failure, the absence of a central message. Instead of finding one, the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, New York, reverted to the habit of anointing an older, and in this case, reluctant, establishment figure, Governor Janet Mills, who would have been the oldest freshman senator ever, ran on a forgettable platform of anti-Trump resistance. In the end, Schumer didn't give her enough support to have a fighting chance. She suspended her campaign in April. Democrats' 2024 defeat sent them on a desperate hunt for a new hero. They're back where they started, struggling to connect with working class voters and scrambling to find an alternative who can beat a strong Republican. Under state law, Platten had to drop out by 5 p.m. on July 13th in order for Maine Democrats to nominate someone else by July 27th. That's a tight turnaround. And on Wednesday evening, the Oyster Man called it quits in a social media video, saying that for the movement to continue, it